Well, let me get to the point. Let's roll another joint. Turn the radio loud. I'm too alone to be proud. And you don't know how it feels. You don't know how it feels.
Call it what you want. A satanic herb, a mind-altering weed, kush, the devil's lettuce. This podcast is about marijuana. This is a story about drugs and medicine, fear and racism, misinformation, and a closed-minded approach to an illicit substance. I'll jump to the chase. Marijuana is federally classified by the Drug Enforcement Administration as a Schedule I drug, along with the likes of heroin, LSD, ecstasy, bath salts, and a host of other dangerous chemicals. This classification essentially means that the drug has a high potential for abuse and has no, I repeat, no accepted medical value. This didn't seem quite right to me. I'm from Washington State, where in 2014, voters approved marijuana for recreational use, and medical marijuana has been legal and available with a doctor's prescription for almost 20 years. A total of 22 states and the District of Columbia now allow medical marijuana to be sold legally from licensed vendors, and 9 more states have pending legislation that would legalize medical marijuana. It seems odd that so many states would legalize pot if it truly had no medicinal value. Right now, smoked marijuana for recreational and medicinal purposes is arguably the most integrated and accepted in American culture as it has ever been. Marijuana, like many drugs, is not good for you, especially when smoked. Heavy marijuana use has been tied to developmental issues, increasing risks of mental health complications. It can worsen anxiety, as well as a number of other health issues. Additionally, marijuana is certainly addictive, although it only affects about 9% of users. While the comparative health effects of marijuana to legal products such as tobacco and alcohol is a subject of frequent debate, this story is not about the negative effects of marijuana. While marijuana is generally not beneficial for most, it cannot be ignored that for certain people, marijuana has a number of legitimate medical advantages. In 1999, the Institute of Medicine found that marijuana can be effective in reducing pain, especially for those with nerve damage. The study also found that marijuana enhances appetite, which is helpful for AIDS patients who commonly have trouble eating. And it has also been proven to relieve the nausea and vomiting that often accompanies harsh chemotherapy treatments of cancer victims. There is significant scientific support for these claims. According to a review from the Harvard Medical School, there is a tentative consensus among medical professionals in the field that marijuana has the capacity to treat and to help the symptoms of a number of medical conditions. However, according to the DEA, marijuana has not, and I quote,
withstood the rigors of science. It is not medicine and it is not safe.
The central question that this podcast will attempt to answer is this. Why in the world is marijuana still a Schedule I substance? Let's go back to the beginning.
Why, what's the matter with this cat here?
He's high.
What do you mean he's high?
Full of weed.
Full of weed?
Yeah.
How old is this cat anyway?
That's a beautiful man.
A beautiful man?
Yeah.
Why, look at that dog. He looks like he's losing his mind.
That's a dog.
He's lost his mind.
Yeah.
Come on, let's get away from here then.
There is a long history of marijuana as a medical substance. For thousands of years, marijuana and the hemp plant from which it originates have been used as medicine. Numerous ancient texts from places as spread out and diverse as Africa, Asia, Europe, and the Middle East all describe the various uses and benefits of marijuana. Even in the now restrictive United States, marijuana was both legal and registered as a pharmaceutical for over 100 years. Even the hemp plant, which has now mostly gone out of fashion in favor of other raw materials, was used for practical purposes, such as making fabrics and rope. I should point out that the fact that marijuana was considered medicine in the 19th century does not really prove on its own that it is indeed medicine. Medical professionals in the 19th century also used techniques such as bloodletting, transferring pus to wounds, and a number of medically unsound and frankly terrifying procedures. However, the general perception of marijuana in the public and in the medical community was as a rather mundane, harmless plant. This all changed with the influx of a new immigrant group and the country's most serious economic depression. In 1910, Mexican industrial and agrarian workers began to revolt against the aristocracy in their country, led by the famous revolutionaries Pancho Villa, Emiliano Zapata, and Venustiano Carranza. The Mexican Revolution was a period of social and political upheaval that began a process of dislocation and emigration from Mexico that did not end until the late 1930s. Over this time, millions of Mexican immigrants crossed the border into the United States in search of better fortunes and to escape the violence in their home country. This wave of immigrants, like so many others before them, was met with a combination of xenophobia and racism from the American public at large. With the onset of the Great Depression in 1929, public attitude towards the new immigrants worsened, as there was widespread fear that the new immigrants would steal jobs from natural-born citizens. This prejudice was reflected in the federal government as well. The U.S. government began a massive deportation campaign that forced the removal of about 2 million Mexican immigrants. And with them, these new immigrants brought smoked marijuana for recreational purposes. From this time forward, marijuana was forever associated with the foreign and the unwanted. Public attitudes and state policy towards marijuana changed almost instantly. Riding the wave of xenophobia, a number of studies were published that linked marijuana use to criminal activity, violence, and a disruption in the social order, particularly in minority communities. A slew of legislation followed. The Federal Bureau of Narcotics was created in 1930 under the leadership of Harry Anslinger, who authored an article which appeared in the American magazine entitled
"Marijuana, the Assassin of Youth."
By 1931, 29 states had outlawed marijuana outright, and by the mid-1930s, every state in the country had heavily regulated the sale and usage of marijuana for any purpose. In 1937, Congress passed the Marijuana Tax Act, which instituted a massive tax on any sale of the substance, and only after a debate of 30 minutes. The only dissenting voice? A representative of the American Medical Association. The film Reefer Madness also came out in 1937.
Feel the soul-destroying reefer, they find a moment's pleasure, but at a terrible price. Debauchery, violence, murder, suicide, and the ultimate end of the marijuana addict. Hopeless insanity.
This movie is about how reefer would destroy the minds of America's youth. And while it is mostly just funny today, it shows how virulent the rhetoric of anti-pot activists was at that time. Throughout this process, the idea of marijuana as a legitimate medical substance was entirely forgotten, and the debate over prohibition was not based on the physical effects of the drug itself, but rather on the social implications of a dangerous foreign product. And since then, in a way, the scientific conversation about weed has always been this way, and still is. This next section is about marijuana, counterculture, and the war on drugs. Marijuana was federally prohibited in 1970 when President Nixon signed the Controlled Substances Act, which officially classified marijuana as a Schedule I drug, which, remember, means that there is no accepted medical value to its use. This law came in the wake of the 1960s and the rise of counterculture, which accompanied a significant rise in the use of recreational marijuana among primarily white, middle-class, college-aged kids. Newspaper headlines from across the country cried out in alarm against the rapidly increasing use of this unacceptable new substance invading campus. A year later, President Nixon declared war on drugs.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse.
Categorizing marijuana, along with other illicit drugs, as
public enemy number one
did not have anything to do with the health effects of marijuana specifically. Although it was clear at the time that drugs such as heroin were highly dangerous and addictive. Instead, Nixon painted marijuana in the context of the culture war. In the same secret recording tapes of the Oval Office that revealed the Watergate cover-up, Nixon was recorded telling one of his advisors on drug policy that marijuana leads to
homosexuality, immorality in general. These are the enemies of a strong society. That's why the communists and left-wingers are pushing this stuff. They're trying to destroy it.
Wow, this sounds paranoid. And it is. Nixon viewed the increasing drug use among college students and the rise of countercultures in the 60s, including anti-Vietnam rallies, as a backlash against authority and the conservative rule of law. In this way, marijuana became embroiled in anti-communist Cold War tensions and an attempt to bring order back to a country that was changing radically. While concerns about the moral fabric of America were the real reasons why marijuana became illegal, and could conceivably have been the stated reasons that marijuana was made illegal, they were not. Instead, the Controlled Substances Act stated that marijuana has a high capacity for abuse and no health benefits. Although the drug war was initially focused on much harder drugs, such as heroin and cocaine, marijuana was a major target. Marijuana could not escape its association with Mexican and Central American immigrants, as President Nixon launched
Operation Intercept,
which cracked down on immigrants and travelers crossing the nation's southern border and submitted them to aggressive and illegal searches for contraband. And indeed, as the drug war progressed, the government began cracking down on marijuana more and more. Between 1992 and 2002, arrests for marijuana rose from 28% of total drug arrests to 45% of total drug arrests, as the number of drug arrests rose significantly as well. Medical marijuana was not free from the same enthusiasm with which marijuana enforcement was carried out. The DEA in California put out a statement saying that bogus medical marijuana claims made it possible for many black market marijuana producers and dealers to escape the justice system. While there is no evidence that this is the case, what is clear is that even medical marijuana got caught up in anti-marijuana rhetoric and anti-marijuana enforcement. The point that I'm trying to make is that the history of marijuana prohibition can tell us a lot about the current scientific debate around medical marijuana and marijuana prohibition. While the passion and the political support behind the drug war has since eroded, continued federal marijuana prohibition is a vestige of drug war era policies and ideologies. In the waves of wholly unscientific anti-marijuana sentiment and legislation at the state and federal level in the 1930s and the 1970s, scientific research was either specifically aimed at proving that marijuana is some kind of social menace, or any scientific research on the subject was completely halted, as researchers and scientists did not want to be associated with a stigmatized substance. During the 1960s, serious research had been initiated attempting to objectively describe the health issues and potential benefits caused by marijuana. However, in the Nixon and Reagan era backlash to the rise of marijuana usage, any kind of scientific research was halted, and nobody studied pot. This allowed the rhetoric of marijuana as
public enemy number one
to continue without challenge from the scientific community. One would think that if the scientific literature was clear on the subject, and that if the scientific community came forward to say that there is evidence that marijuana has medical benefits, outdated laws such as the Controlled Substances Act would be changed. But this is not the reality of the research on marijuana. I have discussed how cultural anxieties about the invasion of unwanted immigrants and fears about the lawlessness and communism drove the early debates around marijuana away from scientific fact and led it towards hazy speculations and vilification. And in a large part, the research is still the problem. The last part of this podcast is about the funding and approval of modern marijuana research. I'd like to revisit the DEA's claim that marijuana for medical purposes has not withstood the rigors of scientific evidence. This is obviously a very strong claim, but I would like us to think about what the rigors of scientific evidence means exactly. As we have learned, research on marijuana was historically either non-existent or was conducted for the purpose of confirming that marijuana would lead to socially deviant behavior. Researchers still have trouble conducting and publishing research on medical marijuana. Dr. Sanjay Gupta, a well-known CNN medical personality, who publicly changed his stance in favor of supporting marijuana legalization, estimated that only 6% of all studies conducted on marijuana were aimed at examining the medical and therapeutic benefits of marijuana use. This statistic is striking and rings true based on my experiences searching journal databases for information on the health effects of this drug. Here is just a taste of the titles found in scholarly reviewed journals on marijuana.
Marijuana use and risk of lung cancer.
Marijuana use and depression.
Messing with heads, marijuana and mental illness.
Marijuana use. Application of a general theory of deviant behavior.
Essentially, if you are looking for information on the potential benefits of marijuana, you are going to be hard-pressed to find anything without knowing where to look. Here's a hypothetical situation. Meet Mr. M. Mr. M is a biologist and a researcher at a public university in New York. Mr. M is interested in studying the medical value of marijuana and the possibility that cannabinoids might act as anti-tumor agents and could help stop the spread of cancer in the body, which, while not to be conflated with curing cancer, is a real possibility that some researchers have identified but not yet pursued. Mr. M first will need to seek the approval of his research from the university, a daunting prospect as many researchers and the school will likely not want to get caught up in the politics of publishing research on an illegal substance and therefore risk tarnishing their reputations. As a federal Schedule I drug under the Controlled Substance Act, any and all research on marijuana has to be approved by the federal government. So after gaining approval from his university, Mr. M would next have to go to the DEA and apply for a license to study marijuana. Next, Mr. M would need to go to the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, and get his research approved from that organization as well. Okay, great. Mr. M has the approval of both the DEA and the FDA to study medical marijuana. So now he just needs some marijuana and he's ready to begin his research, right? But unfortunately, it doesn't exactly work that way. These steps of gaining approval are time-consuming and costly, as well as selective, but they are only the beginning of the problems for Mr. M. The biggest hurdle is getting funding and accessing the actual marijuana itself to study. In order to study marijuana, Mr. M must apply to acquire the drug itself and funding for research from the National Institute for Drug Abuse. Known as the NIDA, the institution has a monopoly on the supply of marijuana that can be used in federally approved studies. The NIDA has a partnership with the University of Mississippi in Oxford, Mississippi, which houses the National Center for Natural Products Research, which is the only place in the country where a researcher can legally acquire marijuana to use in research. Paradoxically, the University of Mississippi School of Pharmacy, which runs the facility, does not, and this is a quote, advocate smoking cannabis for medicinal purposes or any other purposes. And neither is the NIDA particularly open to funding medical marijuana research. The NIDA, as the nation's sole institution on researching drug abuse, does not have any vested interest in funding medical marijuana research because the institute studies the causes, consequences, prevention of drug abuse, not their medical value. And yet, medical marijuana research still has to go through the NIDA. Medical marijuana research is just not on their agenda, a fact that the NIDA representatives have freely admitted. Furthermore, the NIDA is given license to judge which studies are and which studies do not hold adequate scientific value. And because the NIDA is biased against medical marijuana research, it is quite unlikely to ever fund medical marijuana research. There are numerous examples of the NIDA denying funding for medical marijuana projects, but here's one notable example. In 1995, Dr. Donald Abrams, a medical specialist at the University of California in San Francisco, took the necessary steps to apply for a license to study the effects of marijuana on patients with AIDS wasting syndrome, which is a condition in which AIDS patients lose up to 10% of their body weight and experience fevers and extreme muscle weakness. Dr. Abrams, who was granted approval from both the DEA and the FDA, waited a full 9 months before hearing that his application had been rejected by the NIDA. 1 year later, the NIDA contacted Dr. Abrams and asked him to conduct a different study on the dangers of marijuana use in AIDS patients, funding him and giving him access to marijuana to do so. This story is about science, and it is also not about science. The classification process for marijuana was wholly unscientific. Marijuana was prohibited and then classified as a Schedule I drug because of the multiple social contexts in which it was viewed, from racism and xenophobia to a reaction against the rise of counterculture, leading policymakers to believe that marijuana would destroy the moral fabric of America.
Classification is very important, and it is also very powerful. By sorting different substances and different behaviors into what is and what is not acceptable in society, policymakers, they make moral judgments about the way that they believe their world should be ordered. And in this case, these policymakers have kept scientific debate invisible.
So why is marijuana still a Schedule 1 drug? There are many factors. But among them is that Schedule 1 classification is a self-reinforcing system. Because marijuana is already classified as a Schedule 1 drug, it is next to impossible to conduct research that proves that it should not be classified in this way, even though a host of anecdotal and trial-based evidence suggests that maybe, just maybe, medical marijuana has the potential to help people. Medical marijuana has not withstood the rigors of science, because 80 years ago, and then again 40 years ago, it was unable to withstand the rigors of popular imagination and popular fears. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Jared Souza. A huge thanks to Dr. Rupali Padke for advising, as well as to Eli Liliskov, Jane Hornsby, Brenna Tierney, Crystal Yam, Jake Greenberg, Victoria McKinnon, and Connor Vincent for guest vocals. I own none of the audio on this podcast.